This is the Daily Radio Ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the Gospel of John. Open your Bibles to the Gospel of John chapter 6 and let's join Pastor Sandy.
The Bermuda Triangle. Ever heard of the Bermuda Triangle? It's a mysterious area of the Atlantic Ocean. It lies between Miami, Bermuda, and Puerto Rico. In its spacious waters, aircraft and watercraft have inexplicably vanished. Piracy and weather and human error and equipment failure have all been ruled out as possible explanations. Popular culture attributes these strange phenomena to paranormal activity. Perhaps the Bermuda Triangle is a flashpoint for Satan and his devils. To explain the mystery of the Bermuda Triangle, we can only speculate. But there is another triangular set of coordinates that for a few years saw more paranormal and supernatural activity than any other place this planet has ever seen. And we can trace the supernatural occurrences that happened there to a definitive source. During a three-year span, probably from 29 to 32 AD, on the northern shore of Israel's Sea of Galilee, paranormal and supernatural phenomena occurred on a regular basis. Storms miraculously ceased. A sack lunch of fish and chips was multiplied to feed 15,000 hungry people. A surfer was seen on top of the water's surface without his surfboard. Call it the Gospel Triangle. The area between three cities, a mere 3 miles apart, Capernaum, Chorazin, and Bethsaida. Here Jesus did the lion's share of his miracles. The Nelson's Bible Dictionary estimates that 18 of Jesus' 33 recorded miracles, that's 55%, were performed in this small triangle. Tonight we are headed into the Gospel Triangle, where Jesus worked mysterious miracles to prove clearly and conclusively that he was God. Chapter 6 of John begins. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. The sea, as it's called, is a freshwater lake. It's the largest in Israel. It's in the northeast corner of the country. The Sea of Galilee is 13 miles long by 8 miles wide. In the early first century, under Roman rule, a flourishing and populous city grew up on the western shore of the lake. The Romans named it after its emperor, their emperor, Tiberius. They referred to the lake by the name of the city. They called it the Sea of Tiberius. Since the Romans built Tiberias over a Jewish graveyard, few Jews lived in the city in Jesus' day. In fact, there's no mention in the Gospels of Jesus or his disciples ever visiting Tiberias. Jesus spent most of his time around the lake on the north shore of the lake, the Jewish side of the lake, what we call the Gospel Triangle. Verse 2 tells us, "Then a great multitude followed Jesus because they saw his signs which he performed on those who were diseased. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat with his disciples." Now apparently, Jesus retreated to escape the crowd and to have some alone time with his men. Luke chapter 9, verse 10 says that the miracle that follows occurred in a deserted place that belonged to the city of Bethsaida. Bethsaida means house of fishing. Bethsaida was a fishing village on the lake's northeast shore. Now, the problem in locating the town is that there may have been two Bethsaidas. Today, the ruins of ancient Bethsaida are found on a hill or a tell east of where the Jordan feeds into the lake, 3 miles from Capernaum. But the traditional site of the feeding of the 5,000 is actually south of Capernaum. It's a location called by the Arabic name Tabgha. The word Tabgha means seven springs. And the village there was built over warm water springs that feed the lake and make for good fishing. Some scholars think that Tabgha was a second Bethsaida, sort of the Bethsaida of Galilee, as they call it. We're unsure of the exact location of Bethsaida, but we're certain it was centered in the Gospel Triangle, there along the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. Now, the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. This means it was springtime. Then Jesus lifted up his eyes and seeing a great multitude coming toward him, so much for escaping the crowd, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread that these may eat?" Now John chapter 1 verse 44 tells us that Philip was from Bethsaida. He knows the area. Jesus is saying, "Hey, you know a grocery store around here, Philip?" But this Jesus said to test Philip, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may have a little. Now, one of these days, I'm going to do a series of studies on each of the disciples. When you study their personality and their character, it's fascinating. Philip was the pragmatic disciple. Here, Philip whips out his pocket calculator, and he creates an equation that'll decide how much they need to feed a crowd. Verse 10 says, 5,000 men, add women, add children. He figures the cost will be at least 200 denarii. Now, this was a very, very large sum. 8 months' wages. I mean, for a modern equivalency, think $40,000. But there was one key factor that Philip left out of his equation, and that was Jesus. The disciples are about to learn that no matter how little you have or how much you lack, when you've got Jesus, you've got more than enough. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a lad here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fish. But what are they among so many?" I mean, there's a crowd of people, 5,000 men. That means probably 15,000 people. And all he's got is 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. You know, 3 times in the gospel we see Andrew. Here Andrew brings this little boy to Jesus. And it's interesting. 3 times we see Andrew, and on each occasion we find him bringing somebody to Jesus. I want to be like Andrew. I hope you want to be an Andrew and bring somebody to Jesus. Now, other than Jesus' own resurrection, the miracle of the multiplication, the feeding of the 5,000, is the only miracle that's recorded in all 4 Gospels. This was an amazing miracle. I mean, even among the disciples, they saw it as unique among the miraculous. Later in the chapter, the wind and waves are going to obey Jesus, but here, the electrons and the protons obey Jesus. Jesus manipulates the atomic structure of the loaves and the fish, then multiplies the portions. This is a molecular miracle. John does give us, though, a couple of insights that we don't get from the other gospel writers. The Greek word he uses for fish, opsarion, means little fish, little minnows. We usually eat lunch at a kibbutz called Engev over on the east side of the lake. And you can look around in the shallow water there and you can see all the little minnows, the little small opsarion, the little fish swimming around in the water. The lake is full of these little bite-sized minnows. Jesus didn't feed the 5,000 with 2 big grouper. He did it with a couple of sardines. John also tells us that the boys' loaves were made of barley, not wheat. Barley was the poor man's bread. This little boy's lunch was pretty skimpy. It was really more a snack. Cheap bread and 2 sardines. That's what Jesus had to work with. Verse 10 says, "Then Jesus said, 'Make the people sit down.' Now there was much grass in the place, and so the men sat down in number about 5,000. Jesus is creating some organization here. Soon he's about to serve up a massive banquet. And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish." And here's the kicker. "As much as they wanted." It was a miracle. 15,000 people were fed from 1 kid's meal. Can you believe it? And notice Jesus didn't just provide them what was needed. I really like this. It says he gave them as much as they wanted. He allowed the crowd to go back for seconds and thirds. You know, I get tired of folks who cast a cloud of doubt over God's benevolence. Happens all the time. You'll hear people make comments, well, God doesn't promise to give us what we want. He just promises to give us what we need. Well, technically that's true, but it's only half true. God is gracious. He's a dad who desires to give good gifts to his kids. He loves us. It's his delight to give us not just what we need, but what we want, as much as we want. Now, sometimes he can. Sometimes he can't because our desires might hurt us or they might violate his plan. But oftentimes he can. And he does give us what we want, and he even gives us more than we want. God likes to please his kids. That's the God that I serve. And so when they were filled, he said to his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain so that nothing is lost. They even had leftovers. And I love the lesson here. Jesus never wastes a miracle, and neither should we. You know, John's gospel revealed that Jesus' miracles taught spiritual truths. His miracles always carried with them a message. And it's true today. Whenever God works a miracle in your life, don't lose it, man. Don't waste it. Sit on it. Chew on it. Savor it. Always remember it. Never forget. Never lose a miracle. Verse 13. Therefore, they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves, which were left over by those who had eaten. 12 baskets full. Isn't that an interesting detail? Perhaps the 12 baskets of leftovers were one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. I think more likely, Jesus had a whole basket of leftovers for each of the 12 faithless disciples. Here's the point, though. There is more than enough when God is at work. When you factor God into the equation, suddenly it makes sense. Suddenly it provides. Bring to Jesus your skimpiness and let him transform it with his lavishness. Then those men, when they had seen the sign that Jesus did, said, this is truly the prophet who has come into the world. Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. Now, for years, I used to cheer for the Los Angeles Dodgers, but I never knew the meaning of their nickname. You see, originally the team played in New York City, and they were known as the Trolley Dodgers. They got their unusual nickname from the nimble pedestrians who were able to navigate the busy city streets without colliding into a downtown trolley. Well, here, Jesus is a Dodger. The crowd has become a bandwagon. They want to drag Jesus on board. They want to make him king, and Jesus dodges their intentions. You see, the Jews wanted an earthly kingdom with a political king. They wanted a coronation, but the only crown Jesus would ever wear on earth was a crown of thorns. Oh, what they could do with the miracle power of Jesus. The Jews could use his supernatural prowess to accomplish their political aims. Jesus, though, refused to be manipulated. He was determined to do only the will of the Father. And so again, Jesus goes mountain climbing in order to dodge the crowd. Verse 16. Now when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and they went over the sea toward Capernaum. Now this would just be a short trip. From Tabgha to Capernaum, or even from Bethsaida to Capernaum, we're just talking a few miles, either by land or sea. It's just a short little jaunt. We're told, and it was already dark, and Jesus had not come to them. You know, it was dark, but they knew it wouldn't take them long. Just a short little hop. But then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. Now, let me tell you how this works. Topographically, the Sea of Galilee sits in the bottom of a bowl. The Lebanese Mountains are to the north. that they reach 8,000 feet. The Golan Heights are to the north and the east. The hills of the upper and lower Galilee are to the west. And this little lake sits at the bottom of the funnel, 680 feet below sea level. So here's what happens. The cold wind from the north swoops down on top of the warm air on the surface of the lake, and violent storms erupt suddenly. It happens all the time. This is what victimized the disciples. Their little skip across the lake suddenly becomes a fight for their lives. Verse 19. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, remember, at the most it was 2 miles to Capernaum, but they were rowing 3 or 4 miles. You see, minutes of smooth sailing had turned into hours of storm fighting. The other gospels indicate that they fought the storm for close to 8 hours. And in the midst of this tug of war with the weather, the disciples suddenly, they look up, and guess what they see? They see Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat. Now, Mark chapter 6, verse 47 says that by now, this boat is out in the middle of the lake, miles away from where they were intended. They've been knocked way off course. John ends verse 19 with an understatement. The disciples were afraid. I would imagine so. The sudden storm and now the surprise surfer have got them scared. They're rubbing their eyes. What is this we're seeing? I can't believe this. Look, they had been thrilled by the miracle the day before. Now they're being tested by a storm. And you know, God does both. And he works in this way frequently. He thrills us, and then he tests us. But Jesus said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." I love this. Notice Jesus doesn't say the first thing about the storm. He doesn't reveal how or even if he's going to quell the storm. He doesn't say how it started. He doesn't say how it's going to end. He doesn't say what he's going to do about it. He says nothing about the storm. All he says is, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Catch this. He expects his presence in the midst of the storm to be enough to vanquish their fears. Jesus cares more about calming the storm in the disciples than he does about calming the storm on the sea. Peace in the boat precedes peace on the water. And that's the way it always works. You know, apparently the storm, the circumstances, was never the issue. Jesus knew all along he could take care of that. The only real question was their faith in the midst of those circumstances. Then they willingly received him into the boat. I mean, what are they going to do? Make him walk the rest of the way? I mean, of course they received him into the boat. And here's another miracle. And immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. By now they've been dragged out to the middle of the water. And yet suddenly, boom, in an instant, they're back on the shore. They're back docked on the shore. What happens? Jesus takes a little rapture practice, apparently. One moment the disciples are stuck in the middle of the lake. The next they've reached the other shore. They cover the 4 miles in a split second. Verse 22 tells us, on the following day, when the people who were standing on the other side of the sea saw that there was no other boat there except the one which his disciples had entered, and that Jesus had not entered the boat with his disciples, but his disciples had gone away alone. However, other boats came from Tiberias near the place where they ate bread after the Lord had given thanks. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, they also got into boats and came to Capernaum seeking Jesus. In other words, where was Jesus? Several boats had sailed into Bethsaida, but only one boat had sailed out, the disciples' boat, and everyone knew that Jesus wasn't on board. He had not been seen on board the boat. Now the word is out. Jesus is in Capernaum. How did he get there? Verse 25 tells us, and when they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, "Rabbi, when did you come here?" I mean, they're asking about his movements, but what Jesus is interested in is their motives. Jesus answered them and said, Most assuredly, I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. You know, the Roman formula for controlling the masses was bread and circuses. Just keep the people fed, keep the public entertained, and they'll be content. Did you know that Rome set aside 93 days annually as public holidays? How'd you like to be a citizen in the Roman Empire? You get 93 days off, 93 holidays. Games and food and entertainment were government sponsored. You see, Rome realized it was cheaper to pay for bread and circuses than to put down revolts and keep up prisons. And to the masses who followed Jesus, they had this same bread and circus mentality. They viewed Jesus as a meal ticket, as a sideshow. To them, Jesus was a means to an end rather than an end in himself. You see, they should have probed deeper. What did these miracles say about this man? If the miracles are signs, what then are their significance? Those are the questions they should have been asking. Years ago, I led a Fellowship of Christian Athletes group at Parkview High School. And every year, we planned a snow skiing trip in the month of February. Well, before the trip, the weeks before the trip, man, we'd have huge crowds. 50, 60, 70 kids would come out to the FCA group. They would attend our meetings. Why? Because they were hungry for God? No, hate to say it, but no. It was because they wanted to go snow skiing. And it was always interesting. The week we came back from the snow skiing trip, once we'd taken the trip, man, we'd probably have a dozen people show up. Dozen strong. You know, people still have the same problem. People serve God for what they can get out of him. They're interested as long as God helps them advance their own agenda. They think, oh, Jesus will make me rich. He'll make me successful. He'll make me happy. Hey, Jesus will solve my problems. Hey, Jesus will work out my marriage. As long as they get out of it what they want, they'll follow him. But the moment Jesus challenges them with a higher agenda, suddenly they bolt. This was the crowd that followed Jesus. And Jesus addresses them. He says, do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him. See, bread was never the point. The miracle of the loaves and fish wasn't intended as a meal plan in the school cafeteria. It was a spiritual lesson. Jesus had filled their stomachs to teach them that he was the one who could fill their soul. But the masses had missed the message. They strived for perishables, for food and for fun and for force. They tried to use the power of Jesus to enhance an earthly life, while Jesus showed his power to point them to a deeper spiritual life. You know, sadly, as a pastor, I meet folks who are disappointed with God. They feel like God has let them down. And usually these people have a bread and circus mentality. Oh, they long for the food or the fun that perishes. People are so fickle. They serve God as long as it serves them. They follow him for selfish reasons. People still treat Jesus like a meal ticket or a sideshow rather than the Lord. And Jesus' word today is the same as it was then. He says to you and me, do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.